And joining me in the Care of Yes studios this afternoon, I'm very honored to say, are Barry Ancelet and Marcia Godet. Marcia Godet is Professor Emerita in English at UL Lafayette, and Barry Ancelet is yet again Head of Modern Languages. And I can't even begin to say the number of awards that the two of you have garnered, the number of publications that you have between you. But among others, Marcia, you also have published, in addition to Second Line Rescue, which we'll be talking about today, a book called Carville, Remembering Leprosy in America, which was also published by the University Press of Mississippi. And Barry, with the UPM, you have published Cajun and Creole Music Makers as well as Cajun Country. And the two of you have worked together on this book along with Carl Lindahl. It's called Second Line Rescue, Improvised Responses to Katrina and Rita. And before we talk specifically about this book, I want to also tell people that in addition to being in English and modern languages, the two of you are trained as folklorists, and you have trained generations now of folklorists who are scattered throughout Louisiana and the world, practicing their craft. And I guess, you know, a lot of people, when they think about folklore, the study of folklore, may think of something very old or something rather quaint. And so I want to ask you, before we talk specifically about the book, what is the purview of folklore and folklorists in a situation like this? Marcia?
Okay. In a situation like this, I think usually we talk about tradition, but we also talk about traditional cultures and how events or disasters even within the culture affect, you know, how the culture is sustained and also how the culture responds to a disaster. And all of those things, I think, are things that we talk about. But also, there, Barry has a line in his essay that I think is really kind of, you know, pinpoints it. He said, even a tiny rip, you know, in tradition can affect the future of a culture and sort of slightly change the direction of it, which is fine. But it's also interesting to see how those things affect, you know, what will happen to traditions and a culture in the future.
In terms of this particular incident, folklore is, on the one hand, interested in old, very old things and connections that go way far back. I mean, some of the stories that that I've been studying in Louisiana French tradition, for example, we found antecedents that go all the way back to the Middle Ages in France. And so that's one thing that folklorists do. But the other thing that people who are studying folklore do, what we do is pay attention to how culture is constantly evolving and how societies are constantly evolving. So you have to pay attention to right now as well. And the attention you pay to right now is informed by where it comes from. So is there a connection? Is there a continuity? To what extent does the current expression of something reflect a connection, a part of, as part of the fabric of culture?
Well, I think people would find it very interesting, just again trying to make that distinction of this is not a sociological study, this is not an environmental study, but it is a very, very important study. The words you use, culture and tradition and the things that connect people.
Also narrative-based.
Yeah, that's the immediate thing that attracted all of us, Marcia, Carl, and me, in the what was happening with the storms, is that people were telling stories. The press was telling stories. Authorities were telling stories. Ordinary people were telling stories. People who had been, in a way, victimized or you know, buffeted by the events were telling stories. And it's one of the things that folklorists do, we pay attention to stories, you know, and storytelling and what storytelling represents, what it reflects, you know. A lot of folklorists have pointed out that I was thinking of Bruce Jackson, The Story Is True. You know, when you tell a story about something that happened, that story is its own thing. The actual events are no longer with us. the story we tell is an attempt to make sense of it, to give it structure, to give it meaning, to carry that into the future, so that you know the way you remember it will be determined in large part by the story rather than the events. So we started noticing that people were telling these amazingly different, disparate stories. And one of the things that hauled me into this, immediately when we saw New Orleans, you know, after Katrina, we all started thinking, you know, what can we do? You know, well, what do we do? Well, we listen to people tell stories, and sometimes for all sorts of reasons, it's therapeutic. Mm-hmm. It sometimes can help us get to what I have called psychological truth, like how people feel about what happened. And so we started listening to stories. Carl did the same thing. He found himself in Houston with all of these evacuees there, and they were telling stories. And the stories they were telling were revealing. They were cathartic. They were you know, they represented what was going on. And a lot of this stuff was coming out of the moment. One of the right. And stories coming in all sorts of genres. You remember the email, Robert LeBlanc's yeah. email, mm-hmm. or you know, my son Francois, who had hitched my boat to go into New Orleans with his buddy Marshall Nakhan, came back to, you should have seen what happened. What happened? Well, la, 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 you know. And so I started noticing, wow, there's a really interesting, consistent story here, and it's not matching what we're getting on the media.
No, it's not matching what we're hearing as, you know, some kind of official media report. And also, you know, we were seeing that in the past, we tended to think of, you know, traditional stories being passed down face to face. And now we were seeing it through emails, through
it was ricocheting
texting.
All over the place.
I mean, it was just, you know, we were getting it in many, many different forms. And so I think the book also tries to reflect that. But we might also just mention, since Carl's not here, the part of the book that Carl did, and I think sort of reflects something that, you know, folklorists know to be true, but I think also Carl's sensitivity to people caught up in trauma. And he and Pat Jasper decided that the best way to collect these stories, because many of us were reluctant to do what we saw reporters doing, just putting a microphone in somebody's face and expecting them to be able to narrate that story. They had a field school. So they got a grant to teach survivors to interview each other and what questions to ask. And so,
and everybody had a vested interest, right. a stake uh-huh. in that experience.
That's a fascinating part of the book to mm-hmm. read, is those how they decided to teach people how to go out
right.
and tell these stories.
Right.
Very interesting, very, very sensitive. Mm-hmm. You know, as I'm listening to the two of you talk as well, you're extremely sensitive about how you formed this book. Obviously, you were barraged by the stories, whether they were online, email, your son. You were hearing news reports about
right.
General Honoré. They were coming in very, very quickly at that time. But you all didn't publish a book very quickly.
No.
This book just came out.
No, and you know, incidentally, you know, when we first approached the press, I think the initial response was understandable. I said, another Katrina book? And we said, yeah, but this is really unlike all the other ones. This one tells the stories that didn't get told. And it's telling this. These stories are all from people who were in the moment. And this is again what folklorists do. You know, when I did a book on Cajun musicians, all I did was I let them talk. I gave them the voice, and I transcribed what they said and gave them the floor on the page. Storytellers, the same thing. Marcia did the same thing with her Carville book. You know, you let those people have the voice. You let them determine what the story is. And so if you look at through all this, you know, stuff from Acadian Ambulance and Robert LeBlanc and all those people who went in, the people who were taking care of people, the people who converted the Atchafalaya Welcome Center into a staging area. I mean, all of those people were in the moment. These were not people – these were not professional interpreters. These were people who are actually having the experience either of helping people or being helped or most – in many cases, both.
Yeah.
And what it showed, what it exposed to us was the importance of society, of social connection, you know, of social cooperation that in every case – was what worked. And when they said, "Oh no, not a book about Katrina," I said, "Yeah, but these are all success stories. These are all stories about what it worked. What worked?"
And we, I think one of the parts of this in the sort of description of the book is that it's not another book about what went wrong, but
right.
you know, what went right
in spite of the system.
Well, yeah. And I think that's so what the three of you. So beautifully and cleverly did was with these stories that were in the moment have later created this amazingly beautiful story of success and as
survival,
you say, and, survival.
And improvisation. And you see, this is the other thing is that we all noticed, you know, Marcia pointed this out herself when we were looking for what kind of hero, what did the culture hero. She did something about General Honoré. But we were also noticing that there were trickster heroes. Yeah. And there were all kinds. This is another thing that folklorists do. If you study stories, you end up studying heroic types. Mm-hmm. And we were dealing with tricksters. And you know, in so many of the stories that we collected here, the people who managed to help, the rescue stories, the ones who managed to help, in almost every single case, they had to trick their way in. They had to improvise a solution in spite of paralyzed institutional forces, and it almost became a theme. You know, mm-hmm. like everybody was having to trick their way in. Mm-hmm. What was wrong? What went wrong? And how were these people able to do this? Well, in talking to some of these people, Glenn Miguez and my son Francois and so many other people, Tim Supple, all these people from around here who managed to help in spite of attempts to prevent them from helping. You know, what they all had in common was the ability to think outside the box. And it occurred to me that the people who have the best chance of thinking outside the box are people who always assume that never was a box in the first place. It's all improv. It's all jazz. And this is what happens when if you're the kind of person who depends on sheet music and the sheet music blows away. You're out of luck.
Swept away in
but
the hurricane.
But if you're used to improvising, it's no problem.
Well, let's remind people of the title of this book and go back to that idea of improv and jazz. My guests are Marcia Godet, again, Professor Emerita here at the UL Lafayette, and Barry Ancelet, Head of Modern Languages here at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. They, along with Carl Lindahl, have published Second Line Rescue, Improvised Responses to Katrina and Rita, just published by the University Press of Mississippi. So a lot to do with music here, the word improv and obviously reference to second lines. Tell people who may not be familiar with it why you chose that title and how that fits this story that you're telling.
Well, I'll start. We actually had a working title for several years where we were going to call it Storm Stories. And then the press pointed out to us that while you can't copyright many titles, the Weather Channel actually has a copyright
on that. Storm Stories? Is that why we didn't use that?
Well, that was one of the reasons. But also, the more we thought about it, we wanted to get across the point that these weren't just the more stories about the storm, but rather they were the stories about the people who were not the official rescues, that they were all people who were sort of improvising or making up how to do it as they were going along. And I think Carl was the first one to point out that it was sort of like a second line. You had the official first line mourners, and then you had the second line who just walked along and improvised and made things up as they went along. And we liked that idea of, you know, improvisation because it reflected so well what people were doing.
It's all jazz.
Yeah.
Well, and that gives shape to the way you take these stories. I mean, I guess as you all were talking about what you do as folklorists, you're collecting these disparate stories that have threads, that have heroes, that have characters that you know about from your study, and you create this beautiful story of improvisation, but those individual people may not have ever thought about it in terms like that, or us, just, you know, the public, we would not have thought about it in terms. And this gives not only a shape to it, but a very unique, particular shape that says Louisiana and the cultures in Louisiana.
It does. It really does. I think that, you know, there are a lot of places, let's be honest, there are a lot of places that are that can't improvise, and they do. I mean, you know, look at what happened with the Sandy, and so people do that, but we're really good at it. So well, we have a long history.
And the second line is and jazz are such
exactly.
They're already there.
Those are no accidents.
Sort of, yeah. You know,
well, let's
those are no accidents
forms.
That so many people, you know, we're in an area where people cook without cookbooks and make music without sheets, and you know, all of those things are connected. Let me give you one short, brief example. I was talking to Jerry Romero at Acadian Ambulance, and Acadian Ambulance is one of the few institutions that did manage to improvise solutions. And I was curious about that. I said, you know, like, and he told me story after story after story illustrating that. You know, just for example, they were trying to evacuate patients from Tulane Medical Center and LSU Medical Center, which were side by side. And, you know, the people in charge of this were just scrambling, trying to figure it out. They couldn't bring trucks in because there was too much water, and boats would have taken way too long, and they didn't know where to get them in the first place. And they said, you know, we need to get helicopters in here. There's no place to land, and everything's drowned. And somebody looked up and said, well, the top of that parking garage would be perfect except for those light poles. And somebody else said, no problem. Bzzz, there go the light poles. Now it's a helipad. It was such a perfect solution in the moment. You replace the light poles later, but you save the lives. And so this is an uncanny ability to focus on the real issue, the real problem, not the institutional bureaucratic issues, but the real problem was getting those people out.
Mm-hmm.
And their ability to do that. And Acadian, for example, had just story after story after story of people doing that. So I asked Jerry, I said, what is it do you think that made the Acadian Ambulance personnel susceptible to avoiding the paralysis that the chaos and the breakdown in communication had produced in so many other institutions? And he said two things. One, they don't call us Acadian for nothing. So we come from a long history of people who have improvised solutions to relocation and deportation and everything else. But he said, you know, more to the point, so let me give you a story that has nothing to do with the storm. We were called out in a wreck at I-10 where it crosses the basin, and we were told that somebody had been – there would be a wreck, and somebody had flown over the side and was in the water. And so our medic gets there, and he's got no rope. He's got no nothing. He does – you know, and this guy's down there, could drown. They don't know if he's got a broken spine. What's going on? And I said, what did he do? He said he put on a life jacket, and he got another one, and he improvised this little – contraption, and he jumps over the side and gets the guy and fits him in this little contraption, and they keep him alive and afloat until more complex solution can get there. And I said, well, what was the result? He said, well, they saved his life, and he didn't have a spinal injury, and everything turned out okay. And I said, well, and he said, you know, I have to tell you, our insurance people frown on that guy. But he said
– didn't stop him.
No, but it ended up saving the guy's life. And I said, well, here's the telling thing. What happened to that guy? What happened to that EMT? And he said, he was EMT of the month.
Hmm.
I said, well, that's what it is. See, there was a culture of valuing improvisation.
Right. Well, and the two of you have both mentioned words that – I think, mean different things to many of us, but you've mentioned hero and you've mentioned trickster. Mm. And I want to talk about a chapter that Marcia wrote about hero. Mm. And Barry, maybe you can address some of the trickster, because what you're talking about, thwarting the paradigm, thwarting the paralysis, many of the stories that you tell that have to do with what became known as the Cajun flotilla have to do with this idea of trickster, which is a real character in folklore.
Absolutely.
Tell us just about that and then some of the stories that you included in this book.
Well, there were so many stories about tricksters. You know, one of the ones is the one that Dave Spazzali told about, you know, he and his son Matthew were trying to get their boat in and the authorities were preventing them, and there was this breakdown and just paralysis. Nothing was happening. And this guy appears out of nowhere. He's got Army fatigue shirt on with his name tag above the pocket says Quibido, right? So he just starts talking. He said, okay, look, we got a situation here. We have some assets that some of which we can make use of, some of which we can't. That boat is too big. Why don't you go down to this something? You're okay. He just started talking, narrating the moment. And so because he was talking, people around him started doing what he said. And nobody could, you know, why? I don't know.
And this is coming on the heels of official people saying you can't go there.
You can't go in, right. So they had to – and so this guy, Quibido, shows up out of nowhere, and he pokes a hole in the barrier, and he gets several boats in, including Dave's, and they get in. And as Dave and Matthew are going down a flooded street where he said he remembered riding a bike when he was a kid. It was really surreal, you know, with water up to the street signs. And they look, and Matthew says, I wonder who that guy was. And Dave said, I don't know. And they look back, and he's running along the elevated roadway, and he's got Army fatigue shirt on, all right, but he's got plaid Bermuda shorts on. He was just some guy showed up.
Who was that man?
I don't know. And it just gets this hands off to Marcia. And it was – he got things unstuck off a stupid.
And that was not the only story like that.
Oh, there were tons
day.
Of those.
That's right.
Tons of those.
The tricksters
who had to figure out a way around this barrier that had built up that was preventing them from doing what they instinctively felt like they could do.
Improvising.
Yeah.
Improvising as tricksters. Again, many stories like that in Second Line Rescue, just published by Barry Osley, Marcia Gode, and Carl Lindahl through the University Press of Mississippi. And Marcia, you wrote this lovely chapter, and I have to say it changed my entire vision and shape of the way I thought about General Honoré.
Really?
I knew all of those things, but the way you crafted it, your story using the idea of the hero, and I think anyone who reads that will, even if they admired him before, will have just a lovely perception of him. How did you go about writing that chapter?
Well, during Katrina, actually, I had my neck in a brace. I couldn't do a lot of the – couldn't be a part of
it. The Cajun flotilla.
Or something very – that kind of thing. But I did have time to just follow, you know, everything that was going on, how people were perceiving things and sort of collecting the stories that were on the media. And some of them I thought very disturbing. That's one of the things that the media didn't do well, is trying to get, you know, they did tend to get the sensational stories. But I was also fascinated by how quickly General Honoré was perceived as a hero. And, of course, he was a three-star general. He was representing an official body, so...
He's not a trickster.
Yeah, no.
No,
but, he certainly was someone who represented an official part of the government. But he also improvised. You know, when he saw something that needed to be done, he didn't follow the rules. And his justification, you can't really quote him, or I can't quote him.
You have to read the book.
You have to read the book, because, of course, he also got into trouble because of his language. But he pretty much said, if it's going to save somebody's life, I'm going to break the rule. And he said he could take that, and he was reprimanded for doing it. But he was also perceived as somebody who was very much in charge, that he would give orders. And again, sometimes he did break the rules, the protocol of who should have given the order, who had to be obeyed. Part of my fascination with him is that, you know, the more I saw about him, the more I read about him, is that he did remind me of, you know, the ideas about the coming of the hero. That is, you know, the folkloric hero and Lord Raglan's of, in 1930s, you know, the hero of tradition. And he says it's, you know, someone who returns to the homeland in time of crisis and saves the people and leads them, you know, to victory or something. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's kind of getting romantic about what he did. And General Waterway would never say that about himself. But that seemed to be the perception. You
know, and again, we're talking about the way the story is told. The way the story ended up getting told needs a character.
And he provided that character.
Yeah, and people needed to see someone who was in control and somebody who was going to, you know, bring about a rescue.
And change the narrative.
And change the narrative about what was going on.
I mean, look at how much he accomplished with one line. Uh-huh. And he said, point your guns down, boys. We're not here to kill anybody. We're here to save them. I mean, and all of a sudden, the entire perspective is put back in the right way.
Mm-hmm. And so in many ways, even though he was, you know, he was a general, he had that authority, but he was also acting as a native son because he was improvising and he was, you know, telling people, you know, we have to do what has to be done to get people saved.
But speaking the right language. Okay. And
what ward is he from?
Yeah.
What ward was he from?
No, he was from New Roads. Lakeland.
Even better.
Yeah. He was from Lakeland, but he had been in Charity Hospital as a child.
By the way, one of the points that I think it's important to make is that, you know, some of those people who got stuck in New Orleans, that doesn't make them only victims. Some of those people were heroic themselves, as Carl points out, or his interviewees point out. Those people went into improvisational mode as well, and the Cajun flotilla did some great things in spite of the system, but they weren't the only ones. There were a lot of people who were thinking outside the box, and making all of this happen. I don't know if you noticed that some of these things were coming immediately out of the moment. Robert LeBlanc's email that got forwarded to me, we reproduced in its entirety with his permission. Yeah. Unbelievable expression, you know, of what was going on there. And his frustration was, as Francois was, as so many people were expressed, that the press was falsifying the story for sensationalism. I don't know what. For whatever reason, they were getting the story wrong. And these people were in the water up to their waist and in the moment, and they were coming out, and their story was amazingly consistent. And one of the most important things about their story that was consistent, not only was there did they encounter very little, if any, shooting and looting, but the people they were helping, the people they were rescuing were gracious, appreciative, kind, calm. There was not that sense of chaotic panic that we got the impression of.
Yeah. And I think, again, from people who, you know, left, say, not only Cajuns, but people who left other areas and went into New Orleans to help rescue, you know, everyone said, you know, that they were treated as though they were heroes, even though they themselves never called them that. But they said they never saw any sign that these people would attack them.
No.
They never felt, you know, that.
And, you know, this is something that I would myself be very reluctant. That's a comment that I would be very reluctant to make, not having had the experience. But when you talk to 25 people who were in the boats and who all say with 100% consistency the same thing, I start giving that some credence.
And that the people One, the people that were being rescued by outsiders, by people in boats, there was no mob reaction.
No.
That they were very orderly. You know, they did put the children and women and especially older people in the boats first, and that, you know, they praised how this you is know, what, how they were.
One of the things that Francois said when he and his buddy Marshall were going up to this elevated spot where about 40, 50 people were stranded, he said, man, that's a lot of people. You know, this could turn bad. And he said, well, that's what we came for. And so they nosed in and they were telling people, please don't grab the boats. Please don't panic. Please don't grab the boats. As soon as the nose hit the land, three guys on each side got out and grabbed the boats. And Francois thought, oh, okay, what's going to happen? Well, no, they were just stabilizing the boat so that these old ladies could get in. And they said, thank you so much for helping us. Come back when you can, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was just nothing but what gracious appreciation.
And I think
this one old lady, by the way, said, though, she said, who are you? I can imagine, as Debbie Clifton pointed out to me, you know, a lot of black people surrounded by water and some white people in boats come together. That has historical implications. So they were saying, who are y'all? And Francois said, we're volunteer rescue. We're here to help you if you want, get you out if you want. And he said this elderly lady fell on her back saying, thank you, Jesus, for sending your sons.
And I guess after being stranded for that many days with no official help coming, you can understand, you know, her emotion
sure.
and finally finding somebody who came to rescue
you. You welcome the heroes and tricksters.
Yeah, and we've talked about heroes a lot, you know, in this conversation. But I have to say that not one person I talked to said that, used that word.
No.
And as a matter of fact, Glenn Miguez, who was talking about his experience in Rita, who, you know, they were he and his wife and his kids were trying to get out of town. They found themselves blocked by the water. They came back in. The mayor said, Glenn, we need you in your boat. Can you help us? And he rescued people all day long. And somebody, I said to him, did anybody you had picked up contact you after? And he said, yeah, everybody. They were saying, you're a hero. I'm not a hero. I was just doing what I had to do. You know what I mean? Not a hero. They said, you didn't have to do that. I know I didn't have to, but somebody had to do it, and it was there to do, and I'd do it again. I hope I don't have to, but I'd do it again. That was characteristic of the attitude of everybody we talked to.
And just for another quick point to make about especially the people that quarrel, you know, the people who were interviewing each other, we really got the impression from the news that nobody tried to save themselves and help others there.
And they all did.
And they all did. I mean, all of the young men, middle-aged men, old men did everything they could to rescue
family
members.
In an astonishing variety
of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and those are also beautifully told in that second part of the book.
Yeah.
And I love his title of his opening essay, Transforming Endurance.
Yeah.
And I want to tell people who are just tuning in that we've been talking about the book Second Line Rescue, Improvised Responses to Katrina and Rita. My guests are Marcia Godet, Professor Emerita in English from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, Barry Ancelet, who is head of modern languages here at the university. Both are folklorists, along with their other editor of the book, Carl Lindahl, and they have shaped these stories, again, all as Barry said, that were taken in the moment, told in the moment, and created them into this beautiful, transformative experience about how people improvised and endured after Katrina and Rita. The book is available through the University Press of Mississippi. How can people get it?
They can get any bookstores, Amazon,
online,
Barnes & Noble.
Sources.
By the way, if anybody out there listening, if you want an opportunity to be proud of your peeps, these stories make me proud of my peeps.
Let me just point out, too, since people might want to be influenced, all of the royalties from the book are going to New Orleans area
Habitat for Humanity and Louisiana Coastal Restoration Authority.
As I said, academic generosity is beautiful. just an amazing book, and I teared up more than one time in this book and really did change and shape my memories of that time, and I have a feeling it will with anyone who reads it. Thank you both, and Carl as well, for creating it, for being patient and taking the time to tell this story out of so many other people's stories. Thank you.
Thank you.